And we are all most welcome, honorable members, to this meeting of today. And of course, we believe that all of us who have received the documents on time were able to go through them. But having said that, I will start by apologies so that we make sure that we record apologies accordingly. The one that I have received is from Honorable Motsipe, who would leave the meeting early today because she's got another commitment that she needs to attend to. The other approach, which is extending apologies for our Honorable Chair, James, still his apology has to be recorded until further notice, as we agreed last week as it was presented and moved by Honorable Kivi. Thirdly, it's an apology of Honorable Kivi, who will try her level best to log in. However, she feels very weak physically, as she was discharged yesterday from hospital. And the third one, the fourth one is Honorable Malumane, who also, she's still not emotionally and mentally stable to attend, but she promised to log in, but time to time, she might not be able to attend our meetings, honorable members. I'm not too sure whether other members have got any apologies. I'll see by show of hands at the in the platform, honorable members. It seems like there are nine other than these ones. Then may we then ask honorable who unda
bese cool, yes, yes, chair. I have a problem of yes. I have a problem with a pink eye, and I might not be maybe be so focusing on my face.
Okay, that is noted, Honorable Ndabezitha, and I'm sure we are not necessarily suggesting that you log off, but probably in terms of your active participation might be lower today.
Yeah.
Speedy recovery on that score. Honorable Mandy.
Inkosi must get soon. Inkosi must get well very soon. But I must tell you, Lunda, busy. I'm a pink eye.
Okay, social distance noted, honorable Ntuli. Thank you very much. Honorable members, then let's proceed. Today's purpose is to receive a presentation from DPSA led by the minister in terms of the legislative reforms. You will recall, members, that early last year, even late in 2019, we did also caution the department that they must bring legislative reforms on time so that we are not pressured with time. So today, the minister will give us the update with his team as to how far have they gone in terms of bringing legislative reforms, in particular moving towards a single public service as it were. But I'm sure Honorable Stryker, Dr. Stryker will be happy to hear that today. What a coincidence. But also the other one is going to be from NSG. However, I would request that we receive all presentations from a family of DPSA, then we'll end with the Public Service Commission. If that one is in order, Honorable Members, I would be very happy. Before you comment, also may I then also further make comment as opening remarks that this year, as all of us were aware, that it's dedicated to Mom Charlotte Maxeke, and the multi-party caucus is engaging in coming up with a program that parliamentarians and the civil society and community at large will engage on. And also the month of March is our Human Rights Month, which is very appropriate, and I'm sure that the department also at appropriate time would say what have they planned for human rights in their space of operation. Of course, with us, we only be able to move motions in the House to acknowledge and appreciate the month of human rights as it were. Other than that, honorable members, all of us were warmly welcome, and we're looking forward to an active, robust engagement with the department. That will bring us, honorable members, to allow me to ask the minister, Honorable Matungwane, to do the opening remarks and give us a high level, and also to give us who's going then to make presentation or if it's himself, he may proceed. Over to you, Makingwane, and you are welcome with their team, the NSG principal, the acting DG, Public Service Commission, and the Commissioner, Honorable Mr. Dr. Molesi, you are also welcome, and also the DG, the PSA, we are all welcome colleagues and honorable members. Over to you, Makingwane. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Slalo, for welcoming us to the Portfolio Committee once again. We have a number of reports in the portfolio regarding exactly what you have introduced to the Portfolio Committee in the form of amendments or legislative amendments in particular, or new ones where the case as the case may apply. So we have people from DPSA and then from the school and then from where we provide the ministerial support, the PSC. In particular, DPSA and the school, that's where we're dealing with legislative amendments. One of the highlights of this of these amendments, as they will be dealt with, is it comes from long discussions as far back as possibly 2006-07 or something like that, regarding the single public administration in the Republic of South Africa and single public service. We regard this as a groundbreaking initiative, not just because it is done by us, but because of its importance in dealing with the problems of fragmentation in South Africa. We started off very badly anyway in our new democracy with a South Africa that belonged to a racial group, one racial group. And then where the majority were left out, that was the first fragmentation for people who live in the same country. But then South Africa itself was divided into homelands, each with their own administration. There was another kind of fragmentation. But even when we got into democracy, we didn't quite clean up up to a refined stage where we would really keep to the prescripts of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. Hence the fragmentation that we have. People who belong, who work in the SOEs, they have their own administrative dispensation. Those who work at local government, their own dispensation. And those who work for public service, in terms of Public Service Act, national and provincially, they have their own dispensation. Now, this is causing a lot and lots of problems, not only to us, but to them as well and to the country as a whole and government. So we take it as a very important progressive step. In the school, it has something to do with how the school was founded and initiated with a particular thinking at that time, which got into PAMA, but we've come to realize that that's not the way to go, hence the amendments that are going to be tabled here. The rest I will deal with after the presentations. For now, I hope the DG is here and Renisha, both of them are dealing with the first presentation. Whereafter, we'll go to the PSC. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Minister. Over to you, DG.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to all the members of the committee and to colleagues from NSG, from Public Service Commission, and from DPSA who are here with us today. I would like to take over from the Minister and quickly take the committee through the presentation that we have prepared. I have my colleague who is the head of legal at DPSA, Ms. Renisha, who will also be able to support in terms of answering questions. Just in terms of our presentation, we are looking at the context to the legislative amendments. We are looking at the areas for amendment of the Public Service, Public Administration Management Act, which we call PAMA, and areas for Public Service Act, PSA, and the important timelines that we are working towards. Just in terms of the context, firstly, why
COVID-19 training and education?
Minister, please mute your yourself.
Oh, Honourable Minister, kindly mute, please. Thank you. Thank you, DG. You know, it does happen to anyone.
Yeah.
You may proceed. Thank you.
So just in terms of the context, why single public administration? The broad objective of the single public administration is to improve state capacity and capability in accordance with the National Development Plan and objects of the Public Administration Management Act of 2014. Key to this improvement of state capacity, we want to ensure that people have the requisite know-how in terms of attributes such as skills and abilities they exhibit, the requisite value system to ensure their fitness for purpose. We want to ensure professionalization of the public service. This is a critical milestone in building a capable, ethical, and developmental state, whilst promoting meritocracy and training. We also want to improve state capability by ensuring that at a macro level, there are requisite enablers or platforms in terms of systems, structures, processes, governance instruments, technologies and innovation to assist people to deliver on their mandates in driving the machinery of the state, to ensure the building of state institutions. The specific objectives of the single public administration include providing a platform for the achievement of a single integrated public administration system that is accompanied by a strengthened legislative governance and implementation framework. Ensure that such a single and integrated system anchors the implementation and sustenance of a district coordinated service delivery model. Further, reinforce the critical role of local government in building a capable and developmental state as the model seeks to, amongst others, strengthen principles of cooperative governance and intergovernmental relations as envisaged in Chapter 3 of the Constitution. This vision of a single public administration was initially conceived as a single legislation to provide for the organization, management, functioning, and personnel-related matters in the three spheres of government, which is national, provincial, and local. The draft Public Administration and Management Bill was intended to replace the Public Service Act in its entirety, as well as the sections of Local Government Municipal Systems Act 2000. The Public Administration Management Act 2014 did not repeal the Public Service Act, nor did it repeal the Municipal Systems Act as contemplated. So the approach in taking forward the single public administration vision, we have agreed that we must leverage on existing legislation with better and ensure better coordination. And some of the proposals is that the different pieces of legislation must be retained. So local government will retain their own pieces of legislation. National government will retain its own pieces of legislation. The areas in PAMA that have posed implementation challenges must be amended. The following critical areas that are are not catered for in legislation, but which are necessary for a single public administration contemplated in Chapter 10 of the Constitution, must also be introduced. These include removing unjustifiable disparities across government, including public entities, clearly defined employment practice framework, including remuneration and conditions of service that covers all employees, clearly defined mandating arrangements, measures to ensure alignment of norms and standards across the public administration must also be introduced. Just a little a view of the journey that we have traveled in this single public service initiative. In 2002, I think there was a decision taken by the ruling party which gave effect to this single public administration initiative. In 2008, there was a draft public administration management bill, which dealt extensively with organization, management, functioning, and personnel matters of the three spheres. It had 56 sections that were aimed to replace the Public Service Act and Municipal and MSSA Act. In 2014, the PEM Act was promulgated. By then, it had significantly reduced, I think, the consultation process. A lot of the content that was in the different sections was taken out. Some of the areas that were promulgated, Section 5 and Section 6, which talks to transfers and secondments. Then there's issues around service centers to provide services across the three spheres. We have a model service center in Mapona Nyamol currently, which is piloted by DPSA. A creation of common ethos and culture of public service across the three. Provision for anti-corruption strategy and standards of conduct and standard of conduct across, ensuring creation of norms and standards for e-government, governance, ICT in the public in public administration across, professionalization of public administration. Again, there's lots of work that is being done in especially around professionalization of public administration. 2019-20, in terms of PAMA implementation now, the consultations on regulations to effect, PAMA implementation, draft white paper on transformation and modernization of the public service. And 2020-21, consultations with ministers of finance, minister of culture, SALCA on draft regulations. The last time I checked, honorable members, we had received concurrence from the minister of culture and minister of finance. We were awaiting concurrence from from SALCA, and SALCA had committed that they will send us a concurrence letter by end of February. I have not yet checked whether we have received it yet. Approval and rollout of regulations, cabinet support for the proposed policy to inform legislative amendments. What we are presenting today, we have presented to cabinet, and these broad areas of amendments have been supported at cabinet level. Just in terms of the Public Service Amendment, the Public Service Act 1994 was last amended in 2007 through the Public Service Amendment Act 30 of 2077 to introduce a new dispensation in the public service in line with the basic values and principles contained in the Constitution and other legislative reforms and applicable to the public service. Following the proposed reforms initiated within government necessitated by the National Development Plan 2030 and other policy initiatives, there were various court decisions relating to the fields of public administration and matters identified by the South African Law Commission Law Report on legislation administered by DPSA. It has become necessary to review and also amend the Public Service Act in this context. These proposed legislative amendments, there's quite a number of them, Chairperson, that I'm going to briefly. In terms of PAMA, there's an issue around transfers of employees. We went through the amendments to allow for transfer and without secondment, without consent, if it is in the public interest or operationally justifiable to do so. The second one is to provide for transfers of functions that impact on the movement of employees rather than reliance on transfer of legislation. In terms of the National School of Government, we want to amend PAMA to retain the NSG as a national department providing services to all spheres of government. In terms of removal of unjustifiable disparities on remuneration and conditions of service in the public service, local government and public entities, we want to, subject to the Labor Relations Act and any other applicable law, we want to provide for the issuing of a framework for the remuneration and conditions of service and to provide for a coordinated mandating process for collective bargaining. In terms of technical amendments, we are looking at to provide for making of regulations in consultation subject to a 30-day period being prescribed. So currently the regulations require that there must be in consultation, regulations development must be in consultation with Minister of Culture, Minister of Finance and SALGA. And what we are proposing though is that we must have a limited time frame. We must be very clear on the time frames within which those ministers or those stakeholders must process and revert back to the department. To provide the repeal of conflicting legislations where possible, alternatively to include a clause that allows the provision of PAMA to prevail only where conflict arises. The second area of, I'm still continuing with the PAMA, the second area is the PSA amendments now that I'm moving to. So the ones I dealt with were PAMA amendments. I'm going to PSA arrangement, Public Service Act amendments now. Appointment and career incidents management of heads of departments. Here the aim is to clarify, qualified to retain powers with the president and premiers. The appointment and managing career incidents of heads of departments, we will be offering a clarification in this context. Recovery of overpaid salaries and benefits to provide for a mechanism that allows an employer to make deductions from an employee's salary whilst ensuring fair processes that are constitutionally sound. Role of Public Service Commission to determine grievance procedures, to clarify that the minister will determine the procedure to be used by employees when grievances are said within a department, that is the internal processes. Devolution of administrative powers to heads of department, to provide for administrative powers to be vested with heads of departments whilst retaining strategic and policy functions with the executive. This is one of the issues that come out of the NDP document. The head of public administration to provide the director general presidency to be empowered to play the role. So the last two items and the first item, which is around clarifying powers of the president and premiers in respect to appointment and career incidents of heads of departments. All these three areas are directly in our attempt to implement the provisions within the National Development Plan as well. In terms of transfers, which is a PAMA amendment area, currently Section 14 of the Public Service Act allows for transfers and employees where no consent is provided after consideration of due representation and if it is in the public interest. PAMA repeals Section 14 and provides that at Section 5 thereof that transfers may only be effected with the consent of the employees. The effect of implementing the PAMA is that government will not be able to deploy human resources to where it may be needed without consent of employees, even if this movement is in the public interest. This compromises the ability of government to ensure the mobility of employees across the spheres of government to where human resource deficiencies exist or where there is operational requirements that necessitate the achievement of objectives of a single public administration. An amendment to Section 5 of PAMA is proposed to be amended to allow the transfer for employees with their consent and if no consent is given, then after due consideration of representations, and if the transfer is in the public interest or operationally justifiable. The level two, the amendment two, which relates to transfers arising from transfer of legislation, here the section 7 of PAMA provides for the transfer of employees to follow the process contemplated in section 197 of the Labor Relations Act in the event that functions are transferred through a transfer or assignment of legislation in terms of the constitution. This is problematic for the following reasons. Section 197 provides protection for employees when a business is transferred from one employer to another as a going concern. The transfer of a function within the public service does not fall within the scope of Section 197, as the public service is regarded as one employer. There are no changes to employees' terms and conditions of employment as a result of such a transfer or assignment of legislation, and no threat to their employment security. Therefore, it is proposed that Section 7 of the Public Administration Management Act should be amended to provide that if functions are transferred from one institution to another, consultations will take place in the relevant bargaining structures. In terms of Amendment 3 that relates to the National School of Government, here the NSG, in terms of the Public Service Act, is established as a training institution and configured as a national department with the Minister for Public Service and Administration as executive authority. Section 11 of PAMA provides that the NSG be established as a higher education institution contemplated in the Higher Education Act 1997. Taking into account the training and development needs of the public service and having regard to the costs involved in setting up such a higher education institution, the provisions of PAMA are not appropriate and require amendment. It is proposed that Section 11 of PAMA be amended to allow for the NSG to provide services across the public administration whilst retaining the NSG as a department under the purview of Minister for Public Service and Administration. Consequent to the amendment of Section 11 of PAMA, Section 12 should also be amended to take into account the qualifications that the National School of Government may provide based on the needs identified by the Minister for Public Service and Administration. It is further proposed that Section 13 of PAMA should be amended to alleviate the burden placed on Cabinet in the determination of mandatory prerequisite training and development. PAMA area of Amendment 4, removal of unjustifiable disparities in remuneration and conditions of service. In the current environment, it has become increasingly clear that there are vast disparities in the remuneration and conditions of service throughout the public administration, including public entities. This is exacerbated by the challenges in government's ability to coordinate, taking into account competing priorities, especially the constitutional matters and the constrained fiscal. The view is to retain the current structures, but to focus on synergy, cohesion, communication, and collaboration. To this extent, it is proposed that the Public Administration Management Act be amended to allow the Minister for Public Service and Administration, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, to determine a framework within which remuneration and conditions of service in public administration must take place. For the requirement of a mandate from a committee of ministers similar to that provided in Section 228B(2) of the Public Service Act, before the conclusion of any collective agreement or any determination of terms and conditions of employment in the public administration. Currently, we have a number of bargaining councils in the public sector. And in terms of coordination, we need to strengthen that coordination such that any decision of the bargaining of each of the bargaining councils is approved through a coordinated process that involves, or is processed rather through a coordinated process, the mandating process that involved a committee of ministers. There is currently a committee of ministers, but I think there's been more attention in terms of the public service bargaining issues that it has been dealing with. In terms of PAMA Amendment Area 5, making regulations, I think here I clarified, Chair, earlier on, I'm not going to go into detail into this one, but the point here is that we are basically proposing that we must give a timeline of 30 days for the ministers of COGTA, Minister of Finance and SALGA to process and make inputs into the regulations when approached, so in terms of concurrence. The PAMA Area Amendment 6 overlaps with other provisions in legislation. Here, currently PAMA regulates areas that are also regulated in other pieces of legislation. As an example, financial disclosures are also regulated in the Public Service Act, and the MPSA is also authorized to set norms and standards in terms of similar areas in both the Public Service Act and PAMA. In order to address the conflicts that may arise within existing legislation, it is prudent that we consider the repeal of such conflicting legislation, alternatively to insert a clause that will allow PAMA to prevail over other legislation only where conflict arises. Now, Chairperson, I am moving to the last part of the presentation, which is the Public Service Act amendments. The first one on court judgments. In recent years, there's been various court judgments which require clarification and amendment to the Public Service Act. Matters related to the powers of an executive authority in respect to heads of department have been referred to both Labour Court and High Court. There are currently conflicting judgments, and to ensure certainty in the interpretation of provisions, it is necessary that the powers of the President and the Premier are clarified through legislative amendments to the Public Service Act. In terms of recovery of overpaid salaries and benefits, on 7 December 2017, the Constitutional Court in the matter of Public Servants Association, Ubogu versus Head of Department of Health, Gauteng and others, declared Section 38(2)(b)(1) of the Public Service Act unconstitutional. The employer can no longer utilize that section to unilaterally recover monies wrongly paid to its employees directly from their salaries or wages in the absence of any due process or agreement between the parties. In the absence of any provision allowing the employer to make the deduction from an employee's salary, it is required that employers recover such overpayments with the consent of the employee to deductions against the employee's salary, or in the event that the employee does not consent to court processes. It is proposed that Section 38(2)(b)(i) of the Public Service Act be amended to create a constitutional dispensation that is in accordance with the provisions with the Basic Conditions of Employment Act that is fair and that puts in place processes that ensure no employee suffers undue disadvantage when such are recovered by the state. The amendment area two around devolving administrative powers. Here, Section 37 of the Act, Public Service Act, gives an executive authority, as defined in the Public Service Act, crucial human resource powers and duties. Section 7(3) of the Public Service Act vests a head of department with, amongst others, the responsibility for the efficient management and administration of his or her department, including the effective utilization and training of staff, the maintenance of discipline, the promotion of sound labor relations, and the proper use and care of state properties. And such powers are provided for in the public service regulations. Chapter 7 of the Public Finance Management Act, PFMA, vests executive authority with the responsibility of tabling the relevant department's annual report and financial statements in the relevant legislature. Part 2 of Chapter 5 of the Public Finance Management Act provides the accounting officer with an extensive information submission and transfer of asset liability, reporting and transfer of assets and liabilities. The Public Service Act has predominantly centralized powers to the executive authority, and the head of department is vested with very limited powers. This is in stark contrast to the Public Finance Management Act, which locates most financial functions with the accounting officer, and very limited powers are vested with an executive authority. Devolving administrative powers. This requires a realignment of administrative powers such that financial and administrative powers are devolved and centralized with the head of department, whilst more strategic powers are retained by the relevant executive authority. This approach is crucial in achieving an efficient and professional service, such as decision making becomes expedient and efficient if the decision makers are closer to administration. Accountability is enhanced if both administration and concomitant financial responsibilities are located in one place. Heads of departments and accounting officers are better to align budgeting processes to human resource matters if they have vested powers in respect of both Public Service Act and PFMA. The conflicts and tensions that sometimes arise between the executive authority and the head of department or accounting officer is less likely to impact on the administration of the department. Executive authorities are able to focus on the strategic matters and on their constitutional obligations without having to deal with routine administrative matters. And the head of department or accounting officer is ultimately accountable for the output and the performance of administration. To this end, it is proposed that legislative amendments be made to ensure that all administrative powers necessary for, but not limited to, the recruitment, appointment, secondment, transfers, and performance management of employees, including that of deputy director generals, is directly vested in the heads of departments, and that all strategic powers and responsibility which enables policy direction and guidance must be vested with the relevant executive authority, being the political head. The necessary checks and balances will be included to ensure that the role of an executive authority or head of departments are complementary and strengthen good governance and accountability. The PSA Amendment 3, in terms of the role of the Director General in the presidency as head of public service, the NDP suggests for the creation of an administrative head of the public service to whom directors general would report on operational, organizational and administrative matters. It is proposed that directors general should continue to report to the political principal on policy matters. Currently, the Forum of South African Director Generals, FOSAT, the cluster meetings, as well as the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation are being utilized to foster stronger coordination between departments. This FOSAT and cluster system are coordinated within the presidency, and therefore the NDP proposals may be a natural progression to align administrative oversight within these existing structures by locating the function of the administrative head of the public service within the presidency. The NDP further suggests at a provincial level an equivalent post could be located in the office of the premier, that consideration should be given to whether the responsibility of the provincial head could extend to playing an oversight role in relation to the recruitment, performance of municipal managers in that province. Taking into account the envisaged role of the administrative head of the public service by the NDP, the following functions have been identified to be located in the Director General Presidency: the role of Cabinet Secretariat, the coordination and convening of the Forum of FOSAT, providing policy support and guidance to the president on the president's function, coordinating matters pertaining to other departments through relevant directors general and heads of departments, including but not limited to obtaining reports on organizational and administrative matters and analysis, same for the purpose of supporting the president. Providing support to the president for the appointment and management of career incidents of national directors general, and performing any other function that the president may determine. Section 7.3c of the Public Service Act provides for the director general in the office of a premier to play a similar role at provincial level. In terms of the roles of the Public Service Commission in determining grievance rules, Section 35 currently provides that the Public Service Commission determines the grievance rules applicable for the internal departmental processing of a grievance and the process when grievances are referred to the Commission. It is proposed that amendments to Section 35 be effected to provide that the Minister determine the procedure to be used by employees when grievances are referred within the department. That is the internal process. Whilst the Commission remains responsible for the rules regulating the processes of grievances referred to the Commission. The South African Law Review Commission, through its Project 25 report on legislation administered by the Department of Public Service and Administration, identified a reference to Section 30B in Section 31C, which is incorrect. The reference to Section 30B should be replaced with reference to Section 30. So we also will be correcting that. The targeted dates, Chairperson, that we are looking at broadly, we have developed a plan, but we are just speaking broadly on the dates. We are looking at getting approval for consultations by 31st March 2021, consultations with NETLAG, DECO, public and other stakeholders completed by September 2021, tabling of amendment bills to Parliament by the end of 2021-22. I think this is the end of my presentation, Chairperson, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, DG and the Minister. Honourable members, here is the presentation of the DPSA legislative reforms, which is in line with our intent, which is also stipulated in our NDP. It's for your comment now. I'll see by show of hands, honorable members. I've got Honorable Julie, Honorable Dr. Striber. For now, I only see those two hands. Honorable Julie, over to you, ma'am.
Chair, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Thank you very much. Over to you.
Chairperson, thank you very much for the presentation from the DPSA and also the input by the minister. Minister emphasized that this single public service administration is looked at as one step forward. Now, with the presentation by DG, I'll touch on just a few. To say, now that over and above policies and regulations, they are now talking values and principles. I wanted to check, Chair, in the meeting as to whether are they also looking at disciplinary measures put in place for anyone breaking such values and principles. Why I'm saying that, Chair, in the meeting is that we always hear an outcry from our communities in terms of the services they get from our public service. People will tell you that you go to for a service to health department and we are going to be on a bench for the whole day from pillar to post and maybe there'll be a need for you to come back the following day and now take someone who's staying at Mevamhlophe, attending to Ngwelezane Hospital, not from Ngwelezane Township, to say now he or she couldn't finish. So she's going back and taking transport from Ngwelezane back to Empangeni again, transport back to where he or she lives. And same thing will apply the following day. And to other, I'm making an example. I'm not saying Ngwelezane has defaulted. I'm just making an example. And same thing will apply with other departments that are servicing direct, giving direct service to the communities. I fully agree with the minister to say, indeed, it is a step forward. Now, coming to the concurrence with COGTA, what will happen to other functions? You see, integration is a process. Integration is a process. What will happen to other functions that are now seem to be overlapping, whereby you'll find that other sphere of government is considering this black, and you'll find that the other one is considering it as blue. And again, I wanted to check in terms of, yes, there will be consultations in terms of effecting transfers. Insofar as budget is concerned, if you transfer a function from this department to another department, whereas that department has not budgeted to it, and leaving the budget behind, what will be what is going to happen around that? And also the powers. DG mentions the powers of the DGs, and also the accounting authorities. Aren't we going to have any conflict around that as well? I don't know whether I'm clear, Chair, in the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Ntuli. And I'm sure if that's not clear, they'll request your good sir to repeat. For now, let's assume that they've captured your areas of fault that need to respond. Then we'll recognize Honorable Dr. Schreiber, Honorable Dr. Gondwe, and the Honorable Malaki as they follow. But having said that, for record purposes, Marcy and the meeting, may we note that DM Chikunga will join us. She did apologize. It was omitted mistakenly. Yes, then we may proceed. Honorable Dr. Schreiber, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to all the colleagues and also to the officials. And thank you very much for this presentation. Chair, I must say that this is really an exciting moment, I think, in the work of our committee and the work of this sector in general. I think that there are a couple of specific, more minor issues in the bill that perhaps later on or in the amendments that we could focus on. But in general, I think that there are very good ideas contained in this legislation. I think particularly devolving administrative powers to heads of departments and DGs is a very encouraging step. And so I'm very happy to see that we are having this discussion in a very serious manner. Listen, I'd also just like to make a couple of comments and then one concrete proposal at the end, and like to get maybe the minister's sense of it as well. Chair, I think that the presentation mentions the intention of promoting meritocracy. I think that the bill could, the amendments could benefit from making that more explicit, saying that the legislation must actually say that appointments be based on merit. I also understand that there's an intention here, obviously, to ensure that we actually strengthen the independence of the public service. I know the president recently wrote a newsletter where he said the public service should not belong to any political party, it should belong to the people of South Africa. Now, I couldn't support that statement any more strongly, but I do think these amendments would be the opportunity for us to also use our legislative powers to make sure that that becomes a reality. Chair, I'd like to draw your attention and the committee's attention and the minister and the department to the Municipal Systems Act amendments, which were passed at the end of last year. Chair, that amendment contained a provision for the municipal sphere of government, which said that public servants or employees may not hold office in political parties. Now, that is an amendment, a provision that was passed by the National Assembly. I think it's currently in the NCOP. And I do believe that that is something that should be extended to also cover the provincial and national spheres. Clearly, there's an intention here of aligning those different spheres more closely. And I think that that's a critical provision that will actually ensure that there's uniformity, but also critically remove the ability for political patronage and people to be put into positions. I think, again, as the president said, parachuted into positions based on political patronage rather than merit. Chair, my third point is on, I think, what Honourable Mthuli also said, her question around disciplinary measures or ensuring stronger compliance incentives. I think there's a gap and space here to more significantly strengthen the independence and the powers of the Public Service Commission. Chair, I think everyone on this committee is aware that we've for a long time now received numerous complaints and presentations from the Public Service Commission about how some of its recommendations do not get implemented. And I think these amendments is an opportune moment to also ensure that the Public Service Commission plays its appropriate role, including giving life to sections 1964D of the Constitution and 1973 of the Constitution, which actually gives the Public Service Commission the power to issue directions, and in this case, specific directions to ensure that appointments are based on merit. And then finally, Chair, as I say, giving the Public Service Commission more teeth in its ability to undertake remedial actions. But Chair, the good news, and I think that there's an opportunity here for us, all of the proposals that I've just discussed, I've already been working on for over a year now with Parliament's legal advisors. There's basically a piece of legislation that's ready to go. It is currently in the form of a private members bill, but I believe really in the interests of the country and taking this out of the realm of politics, that I would be very happy to propose or to submit that bill to this committee, to the department, to the minister, so that they can take a look and we can work together to finesse if there are issues with some of the things I've said, that we can work together to finesse them. But Chairperson, I do think in the spirit of cooperation and exactly what the president said, removing politics from the public service, let us set an example in this committee. As I say, there are good proposals in what we've seen from the department, but I think certainly from my side, I'd be very keen to submit for the committee's consideration these four points that I've just touched on here. So if I could get an indication from the chairperson whether that would be acceptable for me to submit these proposals in the form of the bill that already exists, and whether we can agree to take that forward, also including, of course, the department, as we further develop this legislation. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Member. I'll leave it for members to react on that as well, and the department and the minister. Then that brings us to Dr. Ngondwe. I'm starting to pronounce it properly. Ngondwe, yes. Honorable Mibi, over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Honorable Lusoma. And let me start by appreciating the presentation from the department and the opening remarks by the minister. Honorable Lusoma, I have a number of questions for the DPCSA. My first question is around the implementation of the PAM Act. I want the department to take us into their confidence around some of the impediments to the implementation of the PAM Act. And I note further that the PAM Act came into effect in 2014, but the DPSA have yet to implement the regulations to this crucial and defining piece of legislation for the public service. Why has the DPSA to date not developed regulations in this regard? And why has the DPSA not developed the framework for norms and standard for the public service as required by the PEM Act? And I have to ask the question, will the DPSA ever realize its vision of having a single and integrated public service if it is unable to move with the speed that is required in terms of implementing the regulations and also the framework for norms and standards that is required by the PEM Act? And then I note that in the presentation, there was a mention of the fact that they want to repeal some of the conflicting legislation, or in the alternative, they would like to include a clause that will allow for the PERM Act to trump other conflicting legislation where, you know, that conflict arises. And I wanted them to be a bit more explicit around the legislation that would have to be repealed in this regard. And I wanted to know what the impact of sections 1514 and 1974 of the Constitution were on this vision to have a single public service that is integrated as well. And then the DPSA indicates that the Public Service Act of 1994 was only amended in 2007. This means it effectively took the DPSA more than 14 years to review and amend this legislation, which is at the core of the public service and its administration. How often does the DPSA undertake the review of the relevant legislation, or, you know, of the legislative framework? Because then it should come as no surprise that there have been a number of court cases that have tried to test the efficacy of the legislation. So I just wanted to get an idea of how often the DPSA reviews its legislation. And then just to echo the sentiments of Honorable Schreiber, we welcome some of the proposed amendments, especially the one around the devolution of administrative powers to HODs. I think that's very important. And I just want to make an appeal to the committee and the department to consider incorporating the private members bill that Honorable Schreiber is proposing as part and parcel of the amendments to the PEM Act. And we just want to emphasize that this has got nothing to do with politics. We're not politicking. It's gone beyond that. It's about ensuring that we have a public service that really lives up to the vision that is in the NDP. I mean, we are 10 years away from 2030, and close to 10 years into the NDP, and we've yet to see real changes around the public service and its administration. So I just want to appeal to the minister and the department to and the committee as well to please take the time to have a look at the amendments that Honorable Schreiber's bill proposes. Even if he does not get credit for it, or the DA does not get credit for it, we are quite happy. We just want to see a public service that really lives up to the expectations of our people, because at the moment, our people aren't really viewing the public service in a good light. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Member. That brings us to Honorable Malatsi, and then I'll make my comments and questions as well. Over to you, sir.
I'm meeting up your news. We can't be interrupted. I think the essence of the amendments are uncontested. I think there is widespread recognition. meeting that we need a far more effective and professional public service, and more so to depoliticize it so that the public service can function for the purposes that it was created for, and to improve the efficacy, the efficiency, and ultimately delivery. And I think one of the key points that is necessary in attaining that is to deal with the unhealthy intimacy between senior government officials and ruling parties. And this, you know, refers to any party that is in power, be it at a local government, provincial government, and at a national government level, that ultimately we want a civil service that recognizes that appointments are done on merit, and that opportunities to get onto those appointments are done so fairly. So I think the bill, the amendments are in the right direction, and that any contribution that seeks to bolster what is being tabled now should be welcome, and we should interrogate it, because I think the exciting part about being a legislator is the opportunity to engage in debates around legislation and how best we can improve, amend legislation so that we can achieve our common goal, which we all share, of trying to have a professional civil service that will help the country realize its ambitions as articulated in the NDP. So I think, Chair, in line with what Honorable Schreiber has proposed, I think it will be useful so that we don't have a separate process to deal with an opportunity that is linked to the one that exists now, that we can have, you know, the full document or submission of the private member's bill that he is proposing, so that we can then see from there the areas that can help bolster what the amendments are currently articulating, so that we can synergize those and then have a far more stronger and widespread contribution that will represent, obviously, even the views of the committee in influencing the final outcome of the amendments. Thanks very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, honourable members. From my side, Minister and DG and the team, I would just like to ask three questions. If I
my hand up. Yes, my hand was up.
Okay. Let me just stop myself then, so that you allow members to contribute. I'm recognizing Honorable Komane, followed by Honorable Ntuli. I can see her hand is up again, and then I'll make my questions. If they would not necessarily be covered, then allow the department and the minister to respond. Over to you, ma'am. Honorable Komane.
Thank you very much. One is struggling with the network here, but nevertheless, let's welcome the presentation by the department and welcome the minister, and also join the queue by thanking them for the hard work that they are doing. Chair, one would as well have some few concerns regarding to the presentation that has been made, and maybe to ask a few questions. As to the transfer without the consent, one would just ask as to how would they ensure that there's no disruption of family lives when the employees don't give consent? And what safeguarding would they then give? Because when you transfer a person without consent, it would go with pros and cons. So maybe if we can be clear on that. And Chair, again, how does the Commission not know the cost of the invoices that are older than 30 days? Because in their presentation, they don't know.
Honorable Command, If I
yes,
may
Hello,
you are breaking, you will continue. However, I will suggest that also you submit in writing, because there will be parts that will lose you, because your connectivity is very challenged. Okay.
Yes. Having said that, maybe let me put off the video. Is the province playing an oversight in instances where the provinces are led by a different political party chair? How will this not cause a political conflict? And is this provision really necessary? Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think without the video on, it's very much audible. Honorable Ntuli.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Chair, I raise my hand back to touch on what Honorable Schreiber highlighted in terms of the private members' bill. I Chairperson and the meeting, I think maybe we should treat the members' bill the way it deserves. For me, it can't be just the portfolio committee members deliberating on the private members' bill of a member. Previously, I was once a chairperson of the same committee, PPP, and my understanding is that it also goes to another channel, like various caucuses looking at it and submitting. I wanted to just touch on that one, Chairperson, to say let the private bill for Mr. For Honorable Schreiber take the necessary channels, not coming direct to the portfolio committee. I'm subject for correction, but I wanted to add that, Chair. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Tuli and Honorable Members. From my side, Minister and the team, I assume that we are not formally tabling the bills now, but we are updating the committee with the work that we are busy on, so that we don't think there's nothing that is happening. And of course, Minister, also you will indicate at what stage you formally table the bill before Parliament through this committee, so that we can also start. But I think it's a work in progress. It's much appreciated and very encouraging, I must say. Secondly, does the amendment take to account the project that you presented and you committed yourself through the President as well to reconfigure the public service, as it were, to make sure that it talks to what the NDP and our current material conditions suggest our public service must be structured in terms of its structure, as it were. But also indirectly, it will talk to the wage bill, as it were. But I think the bill does cover that one in a big way, which I'm very happy from where I'm seated. The other one, just for members noting, is that I think Honorable Julie has spoken to Honorable Schreiber's one, and I'm sure all of us will agree with Honorable and Julie in that space, that let's afford members' bill to be members' bill, as it were. Notwithstanding that he has been very polite and decent enough also to raise it with us, and we'll see how do we jointly navigate through that. The other point that I just wanted to say is that if there are any constitutional contradictions with the bills that will be before us, nothing stops us to send or to refer those matters to the CRC Joint Standing Committee, also to review those sections in the constitution so that it talks to the current intention of the current government as it were, but also which will lead beyond the current government as it were. When we make laws, we don't make them necessary for the political parties because they come and go, but for the institution to remain firm and respond to the needs of our society. Over to you, Honorable Minister and Chairperson, the team.
Chairperson, I'd just like to make a point of clarity.
The very last one, Honorable Schreiber.
Yes. No, Chair, just to guide the discussion because I don't want us to talk about different things. I think Honorable Ntuli raises a critical point, but I'd just like to clarify for the committee and the department that the legislation I'm discussing has been thoroughly drawn up and vetted, but it has not been submitted or gazetted as a private member's bill. So it currently does not exist as a private member's bill that is in my name or in some party's name. It is a thoroughly scrutinized proposal, and my suggestion is let's take it up as a committee, let's discuss it. I'm not talking about submitting it or gazetting it as a private member's bill. It is a submission to this process to ensure that we make it as broad and thorough as possible, but it is not a private member's bill yet. It has not been gazetted. So it's something, an opportunity, I think, for our committee and for the department to take it up and incorporate it where there are proposals, as I mentioned, that we in this committee have long been discussing. So again, in the spirit of what the president speaks of, that this is not something about the public service belonging to a political party. It's something that belongs to the people. And I think this committee has a powerful opportunity to demonstrate that by working together and finding the synergies. So my proposal would be to submit this bill in its draft form to the committee, but it has not yet been gazetted. That's why we have the opportunity as a committee to interrogate and take it forward along with the minister and the department. Thank you, Chair.
Chair?
I had a picture before, Minister, Honourable Minister, 1 second. I was just opening the chat here. And I'm sure all of us that logged in would be able to see, but for record purposes, allow me to read it as an additional question. How will, from Honourable Koman, how will the department ensure that there is no disruptions of family lives when employees don't consent? And what are the safeguards to that effect? Two, how does the commission not know the cost of invoices older than 30 days? Three, having the provinces playing oversight in instances where the province is led by different political parties, will this not cause political conflict? How is this provision necessary? So those are the questions, because some of the parts we couldn't hear what she was saying. Over to you. Let me, before you comment also, Honourable Minister, is that let's separate Honourable Schreiber's one. Let's take that one as food for thought, and so that we don't also populate what the minister and the intention of today's meeting, and we note it for today. But it's up to you, Minister, how do you tend to, if you want to respond to that. Over to you, Minister.
Well, I would ask both DG and Ranisha to respond to questions, and I'll take whatever remains. I've noted some of the questions that may solely need my attention. So DG and Ranisha.
Thank you, Minister. I will start, and then Ranisha will follow in terms of answering questions. I think the first set of questions I heard was from Honorable Member Umam Manduli, and in response to those questions, what we would like to highlight is that there is, on the issue of the public service values, I mean constitutional values, there is a process of engagement with the Public Service Commission on values and principles to identify gaps. There are currently codes of conduct and other mechanisms, including disciplinary processes for non-compliance. So if those codes of conduct or disciplinaries are not being done, it could be because of challenges within the different departments where the challenge, these values are not being implemented at the departmental level, because most of these values currently, the expression on implementation is through the codes, the principles, and other work that is being done on the ground. But the PSC is making a call that says, let's look at higher level, how we encourage a focus on values over compliance as a public service, and there's work that we are doing with them in respect to that particular issue. On the issue of transfer of functions, the human and financial resources usually follow transfer of functions. So when you transfer a function, you must provide for the resources and both finances and human. With the NMOG, there's lots of transfers that have been done within different government departments from one government department to another because of the rearrangement that has been done of the state in the NMOG project. And the resources will always follow that particular function when it's being transferred. That is already established. The issue is around individual transfers. Currently, you require that there must be a post available to which an employee can be transferred to. In terms of the issues that came from Honorable Schreiber, I think that we welcome the comments and the feedback that we are receiving as the department. And just to highlight from our part, that as the department, we have received this proposed legislation. I think it was referred by the presidency, and we will certainly be working with the presidency in terms of giving comment or giving advice in relation to this particular proposed legislation. We have since received it, and we are working towards giving a feedback to the presidency. Honorable Gondwe, I think that I'm going to ask my colleague Renisha to answer some of the questions that came from Honorable Gondwe. Honorable Malat, you has raised an issue around the unhealthy intimacy between senior government officials and ruling parties, and an issue that we need to give an eye on. And I think it links to the recommendation that was made earlier on by Dr. Schreiber, that we must not consider adding a provision that basically bars public officials from participating, from holding party positions. Honorable Komane, transfer without consent. How would you ensure there is no disruption? Renisha, I'd like you to take this question as well. And then there's a question I didn't understand. If a province is led by a different political party, wouldn't this lead to a political conflict? I think the point around the single public administration is to professionalize. Part of the work that is being done is around professionalizing the public service, so that the public service as a machinery, public administration as a machinery, is can be able to operate irrespective of who is the political party that is running government at a particular time, because the system to support that that political, that machinery becomes the public administration in terms of implementation of services that we have to provide to the public. So that's the context, but I think Minister maybe would also take this particular question. I don't know. Honorable Soma, the question you have asked, do we take account to the project of reconfiguring the public service to align to NDP in terms of these amendments? So these amendments are part of a bigger work that we are doing around optimizing the public service. This is just but one small component. There is a project that Minister has approved in terms of the work that we are doing around optimizing the public service. And I think at the right time, we will come to the committee to report on that particular project. But this is just one portion of the project. There are issues that we need to we are dealing with around productivity of the public service. There are issues that we are dealing with in relation to managing the wage bill There are issues that we are dealing with around professionalization of the public service, the interventions that we need to do around skills audit, around strategic human resources management in the public service. So this is just but one component of a bigger project that we are working on. And I do think that at the correct time, we should be able to come back to the committee to give a briefing in relation to that particular project. The last one for me, there was a question in respect to the time frames by when the minister is planning to bring this to the committee. In terms of our targeted dates, we had indicated that we want to start with consultations as soon as possible. Yes, this is the broad issues. We have worked them into an amendment legislation, which must still go to cabinet. Once cabinet approves, then we will start the process to engage with NEDLAC and the other structures that we must engage in. And this is the process we are hoping would be completed by September 2021. And we are planning for the tabling of the amendment bill to parliament by end of 2021-22 financial year, which is around March 2022. But the minister had indicated to us that that time is too far. He needs to move faster on this thing. And we are consistently looking at how we can review the timelines to be able to accommodate also the agents that's required, whilst following all the processes that we need to follow before we take a document that is ready to go to cabinet. Chairperson, with your permission, if I may ask Renisha to please take the other questions that I've asked her to take care of. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, please. Yes, please. Thank you. Thank you, DG. Good morning to the committee members, Minister and DG and colleagues. I think there's very few questions that DG has left, and I'll try to sum them up. Honourable Gondwe, the amendment in 2007, since then it was quite a substantial amendment that we did to the Public Service Act in 2007. Since then, we have been implementing that particular act in its amended form. In 2016, we did a complete overhaul of the public service regulations. We needed time to let departments process those regulations and process those amendments to identify the areas that needed further amendment. Now in 2021, we are in better place to deal with the amendment, taking into account the issues that have arisen since the amendments. Hence, we are bringing the legislation in 2021. The second issue in terms of, from Honourable Khomane, we have dealt with transfers in the public service without consent. And some of the measures that we have put in place is to ensure that there is an opportunity for employees who are considered for transfer to be consulted and for them to make representations before any administrative action takes place in that regard. So those processes will continue to be in place. There must be representations. There has also been various court cases that have evolved over the last couple of years that require specific processes to be followed in order for transfers to be properly effected. And our intention is to ensure that those processes must be adhered to. On the issue of the implementation of PAMA, I think it's important to mention that since 2014, we have implemented 13 sections of PAMA. There are the remaining few sections that have posed challenges where they either need regulations for its implementation or it needs the amendment. Both those processes are the processes that the minister is currently undertaking. In terms of the regulations, we have processed two sets of regulations. We have done the full public participation processes. We are at the point where we, in terms of the Public Administration Management Act, we are required to get the concurrence of the Minister of Finance, the Minister of COCTA, as well as SALGA. Those are quite onerous obligations. We have since received, as DG has said, the concurrence of the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Culture. We are still struggling with the concurrence from the SALGA. SALGA has undertaken that they are holding their next expo on the 10th of March, and they will revert to us soon thereafter. So we are hoping that we get a yes from SALGA in that regard. I think part of the challenges with PAMA is this onerous consultation process with regulation. Hence, one of the amendments we are processing is to make this consultation process a bit less onerous so that we can get regulations out faster. I think that's the number of questions that I had remaining. Thank you to the committee and the DG and the minister.
Thank you very much. Back to you, Minister, if you want to make closing remarks.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chair, and the honorable members of the committee. You too are honorable. I must just say thank you, Chair, honorable Chair. I think more than a fair amount of work has been done by the departmental officials in terms of responding. But just to refine our response overall and also synergize it such that we have things that we come out with from the committee meeting. The first one is around what the Honourable Member and Dooley asked about the Code of Conduct. All of us would ideally wish that each and every breach of ethics and integrity in the context of what we are trying to turn around in the space of public service in the country, that it had a particular specific code and way of monitoring and consequence. Just like the criminal code in South Africa, but it's a matter that we have to remain seized with going forward, because at the moment, if somebody is regarded as lazy in the public service, we don't have a specific code that would say this fellow has breached, except if that laziness leads to omissions with regard to submissions of this and that, or performance of duty in line with deadlines and so on. And so it comes in an indirect way. But I do want to say that there are cases where you know, even in a school setup, in a hospital or clinic setup, wherever there is a public service to be rendered, that so-and-so is generally lazy and lethargic. But you can't at the moment say you are being charged for laziness unless it leads to a breach in terms of deadlines and other related matters. But it's not something that we are ignorant of or that we care less about. Hence our regular calls to public servants that we won't tolerate, and particularly to supervisors, that we don't tolerate things like laziness, things like, you know, just walking around and so on. But we see the impact in public service. It's not generally rife, these kinds of deviant behaviors. But let me go to the next question. I note what Dr. Schreiber had to say, and we thank you for those comments. And indeed, that is what we are working for, that public administration generally in the country, and public service in particular in this context where we are at the moment, should work for South Africa across the board. And in this context, we've outlined and put a lot of emphasis on four components in the public service space. That the first component, not in any order of priority, but in a kind of chronology, but also equally important, that there are people in the public space that are clients of public service across the board, and they are very important, and they are often ignored, and they are not spoken about more often than we do for public servants. Public servants take the advantage that they have unions and they are organized, and they then articulate their demands and so on and so on, and they occupy newspaper space and all of us because of the way they do their things and so on. So they are kind of very dominant in the public space. But I'm saying the first component is the people, and we are seeking to elevate the importance of people, the citizens of the country, equally into the public space so that they do get recognition that they deserve. In any case, they are the first on the line, because after elections, just immediately after elections, even before you announce the results, there is this open space before you install new government, even though legally you would say the president is still there until another president is, but immediately after you go and vote, there is a gray area there in terms of, but people are there, it's known that there's no gap, but in government there will be a gap, and therefore we regard people as coming first into the space, into the public space. The second component that comes into the fore shortly after elections is the government as a choice of the people after voting. And so government is a component in the sense that it summarizes and assumes responsibility of the aspirations of the people up to taking up office. They then would say, we're here at the behest of the people in terms of the outcome of elections, and they would say, people have said 1, 2, 3, and we're going to act accordingly. So they are the second component. And the third component is the service itself, which all of us often don't talk about, and we regard that as very important, because that's the substance of the contract between the people and government, the substance itself. We often talk about it in passing, like when people are angry at not receiving service and of this kind and that kind. But we have been a little bit slow in highlighting the service itself to the level where it is equally important as a component, not in passing terms, but saying what is the impact of this service that we are giving to the lives of ordinary people who we claim to serve all over in the four corners of the country. So the service itself, the quality thereof, the impact in terms of possibility of changing people, especially those that whose socio-economic conditions make them vulnerable. So how are our services impacting on that? And we need to measure them accordingly. Then the fourth component is the public servants themselves who get hired to render the service. The substance of the contract between the people and government. And therefore there are four components in the space. And very often both Parliament and ourselves in the executive, we've got to check ourselves in terms of how we are able to make an impact in our deliberations on the four components without one at the expense of the other. And so on, but we appreciate the comments by Dr. Schreiber. But one thing that I want to talk about in relation to local government, Chair, is Parliament has not, or no, has anyone really raised the issue of this issue that we are posed to address if single public administration and public service, single public service in South Africa go on and become reality. In local government, even if the council is 5 months or 6 months before expiry of their term, when they hire an MM, they would give them a term of 6 months. In other words, the duration of the council. How and why this was done, I wouldn't know, throughout the Republic. And I think that's a typical example of merging administration and political office, which in my view is not necessarily required. And we need to de-link that, just like we are doing with a host of other measures, including what you have been commenting about, delegations of responsibilities to accounting officers in relation to national and provincial government. We have to do the same at the local level. Not only that, but also de-link this terms of office, because I mean it's a typical example, one that really is not required. You hire a municipal manager, say for a year, and is an excellent fellow, but just because the term of office of council is expiring, and then his or her term of office has to expire, irregardless of performance, and we need to deal with. That's an example of what we need to tackle. PSCS, in terms of independence of powers, were gradually wanting to make sure that PSC is not only a platform to table grievances and then they react to those grievances. We want them to be proactive as well, and we need an enabling environment wherein they can be proactive so that they monitor things and processes in public service right from the beginning up to the end, and of course without them being compromised that they've been part and parcel of this, but just playing the oversight role in terms of prescripts and compliances. They get given intervals to check and intervene, and of course the bulk of their work at the end of the day. The next issue, the Honourable Member was asking about the impediments, and I think Renisha has done justice there in terms of responding to what was there, but we're in a different setup now where we are on the march and moving forward. And the next one is reviews, and I think Renisha also did justice there. And of course, the comment I can make once more on Dr. Schreiber's input is that yes, we would love to have access to the submission and see how it can be incorporated in some of the things that we are doing, particularly in single public administration and public service in South Africa. That would be welcome until things become clearer. And of course, the department is managing when we'll come back to the committee with the bill. And we are very keen to do it, as was indicated, in this financial year. And whatever difficulty, we're hoping that we'll overcome those. The last two things I want to say is that, yes, we would want to make a specific request, Chair, to come back to the committee, even if it means on a special sitting basis for the committee, that we come back to present the issues around optimization, which we often refer to as the new dispensation in the public service. at the end of what is normally called a cycle in terms of agreements between government and labor in the public service space from 2018, and now we're poised to start a new phase, whether you call it cycle or phase or dispensation. We call it a new dispensation for a number of reasons that we'll state. You are aware that unions are making what is normally called demands, and we have an issue about that in a way, but we do know the normal language that is used and so on. So if possible, Chair, I've been made aware that we are heading for the last meeting of the Portfolio Committee around 17-18 March. On those days, 16 and 17, we would be engaging with Labour at the PSCPC. We would have loved, maybe it will go to the first week of April or so, unless there's a special committee meeting that you can afford us towards the end of March. A longer period, something like 4 hours, where we would prefer towards end of the month than beginning of April, to sit with you, to take you to confidence on a number of initiatives that are being taken with regard to the new dispensation in the public service, with regard to government and labor, including the current demands and so on, if I could speak like that. And what we have to say, what we are introducing into the public service space. And I must be honest and say we would require your support in this, because it's not just something that we think the executive will run with alone. It's something that requires the whole of the Republic, not only in regard to the in reference to the wage bill, but because it's quite significant changes that we want to bring about, which will have an impact on dealing with the wage bill, but also some of the required changes in the public service space at this particular moment. And therefore, Chair, if you could consider giving us space after the 20th, then we can look at diaries, no less than 4 hours, but I would promise not more than 4 hours either. Thank you very much, Chair, for your attention, and the members of the Portfolio Committee.
Thank you very much, Honourable Minister and your team. Safe to say that we are encouraged and excited and looking forward to the bill when it's text before Parliament. But also if need arises, which is second point, need arises for constitutional amendment, we shall direct them accordingly so that Parliament can look at them, the possibility thereof, so that whatever we do at this level does pass the master scrutiny. And then we accept the progress thus far. Four is that we will add honorable or encourage honorable Schreiber to formally forward his intended amendments to the administration so that he can be forwarded to the department, to your good self, honorable minister, because he had formally also introduced here indirectly, but was saying that it will probably enrich the mooted bills, as it were, by the department, and we see how do we then work around that one. And the last point is that we are going to accommodate your good self, minister, and your team, definitely, which means members note that the program might be slightly be amended to accommodate the minister and his team in the near future. With that, I will request that we quickly take both a presentation, both from the Public Service Commission, and we note whatever questions we may want to ask, and also take the NSG, and then after that we engage. And when we ask questions, then we must be specifically direct to say this PSC or NSG, so that we can save time. I can see that we have almost taken the half of the intended budget time, but which was very critical, because that's a very foundation that we need to get it right and understand from the beginning collectively, both the department and ourselves as the committee. With that, honorable members, if you may allow me, then we move and allow Dr. Molesi, you'll assist me in terms of pronouncing your surname correctly, and also in your team, and take over and take us through. Thank you very much, sir. Over to you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Honorable members, Honorable Minister, and colleagues. The Public Service Commission consists of 14 commissioners, five of them.
One second, Doc. Let me just interrupt you. Don't deal with the housekeeping matters, because your organization is coming for more than 20 times in this administration. So just go to the actual substance of the intended presentation, as it were, just to save time. Thank you, Honorable
Chair. I'll make just a few remarks before I hand over to the acting DG. I will deal quickly with the vacant post of the DG, and this in the Office of the Public Service Commission, which is being handled by the Presidency as a legislative requirement. That's my first remark. The second remark is the institutional practice review of the PSC, which is an internal process, has embarked on a process of amending the Public Service Commission Act, and the amendment bill has been tabled in Parliament, and we appreciate that it's a process and it's going to take time. The Public Service Commission Act amendment bill is, among others, about strengthening the independence and powers of the Public Service Commission as stipulated in the Constitution. The last remark I will make is regarding the public service rules and the rules-driven and the values-driven public service. The public service rules and the constitutional values and principles are equally important for the efficiency and effectiveness of the public service, and must be complied with and equally must be adhered to throughout the public service. This will be covered also in the presentation by the acting DG. I will then hand over to the acting DG. Thank you.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Minister. Thank you very much, Commissioner. Commissioners in this meeting, good morning, and good morning, colleagues. My name is Irene Matenjo. I'll be taking you through the presentation on the constitutional values and principles. As a way of kicking off, Okay, as a way of kicking off the presentation, we have got an introduction there. Just that seeks to give a bit of context for the Public Service Commission. If you look into section 196, that gives the PSC the mandate really to promote these values, but also to provide an evaluation of the extent to which the values and principles are complied with. As we move on to the next slide, we are just really showing these values and principles that we are talking about. In the middle, obviously, you'll find those founding values as contained in both the preamble in Section 1 of the Constitution, but also the principles in the dark red outside there. But I think for the Public Service Commission, what has been really worrying us is why is it that the Constitution has been so clear in terms of the things that the public service and public administration should be complying with, yet we still see a lot of things that are worrying us. Just as an example, we see commissions of inquiries that are taking place day in and day out. We look internationally, do a reflection on ourselves. We find that the country is experiencing downgradings of our SOEs. And some of those, when we look closer, for instance, you find that your Moody's and your Fitch, they will tell you that ESCOM's problems are around just accountability and transparency. You look at the SAA, they will tell you the problem is about efficient, effective, and economic use of resources. And this really just takes us back to the basics of what the Constitution wants. And similarly, again, things that are happening in our public service, we find kids are dying in pit latrines, the manner in which the citizens are being treated. And we just go back and ask ourselves, and we found that the answer actually is in very simple things like, how do we offer human dignity and equality and human rights as the public service and public administration around how we do our work? But perhaps what is also important, Chairperson, is that these slides take us to the importance of understanding that for us to reach the ultimate goal of our national development plan, we would need to take these issues on this slide very seriously if we are serious about issues of unemployment, inequality, and dealing with poverty. As we move on, Chairperson, given that what we are saying is that perhaps there is a need for a systematic program to change the form and character of our public service, and will really require a collective effort. Those that are in government, but also those that are our citizens will have to help us to achieve this one. But most important, the central policy departments will have to play a role. And I'm happy, Chairperson, to indicate that we are working with the National School of Government. We are working with the DPSA. We have had engagements separately with them around some of the matters on the constitutional values and principles. And what we are saying is that perhaps our democracy has invested in institutions of governance by promulgating laws and regulations, which is good because we need the laws and the regulations. Otherwise, we'll be a chaotic state. But we have made less of investment into the internalization of the values at the level of human consciousness. Yet we often suffer from issues of how we treat our citizens with human dignity, equality, and so on. And therefore, we also argue that we tend to lean more towards the mechanistic, rules-driven, and compliance and regulatory approach to public administration, so much so that the intent of the constitutional values and principle, particularly the service part of the service delivery, really just lacks care and responsiveness. Chairperson, as we proceed with that issue, we are saying that we need, I'm not going to be speaking to all the bullets and so on. I will also emphasize those that I came. We say that there is a need for a right balance to be struck between compliance and values-driven performance. But also we've taken cognizance that some of those in the private sector have fallen into this trap and could not prevent the major corporate failure. So it's not just us as the public service. And surely issues of political patronage, as Minister was talking to earlier on, and the interference led to instability in the administration and even fear of reprisal, resulting in retreat to the safety of compliance with rules. And this has also stifled innovation. In this light, we're just making a little bit of demonstration of what is it that we are talking about when we talk about a rules-driven rather than a values-driven public service, and why we should transition from the rules-driven, which I said is still very important, but making sure that the rules are helping us to achieve a particular outcome. Just making an example, our colleagues, those that are in supply management, often they get bogged down to things like, has a specification been prepared, a tender properly published and evaluated by a properly constituted bid? And these things are very important. They have to happen. But I guess what then we don't entertain is, what is the best product to really address the problem that we're facing with as the public service? What are the ruling prices and who are the suppliers and what are the market conditions? So that we ensure that at the end of the day, we have bought the right product to address the right problem that we are facing with. The same applies in the HR space. Every day when we go through the recruitment and so on, we look on the job description, had the job been evaluated, properly advertised, was the selection committee properly constituted. All of those things are important. They have to be done. But at the end of the day, we tend to pay less attention to what is our recruitment strategy or whether have we made a good appointment. And what we are saying is that if we pay attention to the former, which is the job description and so on, we will find that continuously after 3 months, 4 months, we realize that we, despite that everything that we have done according to the book, we have appointed the wrong person into the position. So that is just the example that says, whilst the other things are very important, we need to make sure that indeed they help us arrive at the bigger things that we really want to achieve, particularly towards our national development plan. And we also argue that perhaps there has been some kind of a limited scope to think out of the preconceived planning frameworks, and we see a huge disjuncture in terms of institutional compliance, due diligence, and citizen satisfaction. Whilst on the other hand, we are complying and sending all reports that are required and ticking all the boxes, is the very same citizens that we are serving at the end of the day that would tell you that we are not happy with the performance of the department. And our communities, obviously, they remain largely faceless with our participation projects really to legitimize institutions. So our discourse is developmental. There's no argument about that. But what we're saying is that our public administration remains a stiff. So the question is it a public administration that is rules-driven or values-driven? None of the both take precedence over the other. But what we're saying is that the emphasis should be on a values-driven public service that take cognizance of the fact that regulatory framework exists to enable service delivery and impact on society. I'm also happy that we're having this discussion at the time when the DPSA has also made proposal about some of the things that we are putting forward to also Parliament to say that these are the things that I have to change, because it's an acknowledgement of the rules as they are not helping us to achieve the things that we really need to achieve. And that is where, as Public Service Commission, we're coming from. And to avoid a situation where all the time public servants are very much comfortable to hide behind the rules, even when we realize that they are not helping us at a point in time, and therefore they have to be reviewed to better address the challenges that we have. Chairperson, as we move on, I'll move from one principle to the other. The messaging is pretty much the same, and as I've given in terms of the background, and we'll take one principle at a go. On this slide, we're talking to the high standard of professional ethics. And what we're saying is that ethics, our ethics has largely been reduced to institutional issues like disclosure of financial interest, appointment of ethics workers, officers, the remunerative work outside of the public service and issues relating to anti-corruption strategies. And these things, yes, as Public Service Commission, it's part of our work. It's very important. We'll continue doing them. But we have taken a little bit of reflection and say, to what extent are these things closer to the daily experiences of citizens and how they closer to the daily experience of citizens and how when they interact with public servants through their conduct and their in our daily interaction with them. So we find ourselves that besides doing all of this, the citizens will tell you that the officials in the Department A are very much unprofessional. Yet, on the other hand, there are things that we are doing as government in our course of making sure that we achieve a high standard of professional ethics. So also, there seem to be a little feedback on behavior and conduct of officials on the impact thereof on service delivery and the citizens. And this is largely to those that are interacting with citizens on daily basis. We do service delivery inspections. We go to hospitals. We go to schools. We go to SASSA offices. And some of our observations is that when we get there, we find that some officials, not all of them, some officials, the manner in which they behave, and you look around and you want to see whether there is anyone within the staff of the department that is picking up on these things, that is addressing those things immediately. And we tend to fall short a little bit. But also on the issue of the code of conduct, which is a very good piece and a tool for us really towards the high standard of professional ethics. But we're also arguing to say departments must look at the code of conduct, but also adapt it for their particular departments. People must look into what are the mandates of the department, what are the ethical dilemmas facing that particular department. What are the things that are a no-no? And how are we even beginning to engage officials in those departments that says, if you are a citizen-facing department, such as Department of Health, our professional ethics should also look into how we treat patients. And this applies to everybody from the main entrance of the hospital to all the health professionals. Very important. But perhaps one of the things that is very important when we're talking about this issue is that the public service should also concentrate on selection criteria for entry into the public service and socialization into public service value system and culture. There is a need for us to begin to define who is the real public servant in our South African context. One would understand the socioeconomic injustices of the people of this country and where the Constitution and the NDP envision to take this society to. As we move on again, we're just making a demonstration here very quickly. I'm not going to spend time here. That on one hand, we are doing very well. We're achieving 98% of financial disclosures of our senior management services. But the real issues out there when you interact with citizens, they will still tell you that by and large, our senior managers are not professional. Why are they appearing in the commissions of inquiries, testifying and all those kind of things? That's just as an example. Chairperson, again, and when you look at issues of financial misconduct in relation to the monies involved and the monies recovered, at the time of doing this slide, we did not have the audit outcomes from the Auditor General. But really, if you look at 2018-2019, you would look also 2019-20, you would look into the number of financial misconduct and the monies that have been involved and the amount that has not been recovered. Then you look into the figures that are being shared by the Auditor General and you are realizing that there is a lot of money that along the way we really fail to account for. The second principle that we deal with in the Constitution is the efficient economic and effective use of resources. Again, here what we are saying is that departments are allocated budgets that are meant to facilitate service delivery. But we looked at all the national departments and we said to ourselves, okay, departments set themselves targets for the financial year. and there are allocated budgets. How are we doing here? You have got departments such as military, veterans, health, energy, social development, justice, just as an example, that have achieved less in terms of what they have planned to do in the financial year. And when you look at their expenditure of the budgets, they are hovering around 95, 99. Social development, as an example, they even spent 108% of their budget. Where else, when you look at the plan targets, they achieved 52%. So this is really worrying us as Public Service Commission, particularly around the efficient economic and effective use of resources. And whilst the previous slide has focused on the annual targets, we also did a reflection on the MTSF. And obviously, we can only talk about 2014-2019 MTSF target, where we had 843 indicators and only 40% were achieved. And I think in that slide, we begin to unpack. Obviously, the slide was provided by the DPME program of action. You would see that across all those outcomes that we had for the MTSF, how we were doing in terms of certain areas where we couldn't even provide data in terms of performance. Yet every project that is put into the APP is budgeted for, and it's required in terms of our planning framework that those projects must be budgeted for. Again, I'm not going to spend too much slide on this, too much time on this slide. It's still on the principle number 2 on payment of invoices. I just need to indicate that I picked up earlier on that there's an honorable member who indicated that there is no information regarding the cost of invoices. I've requested our parliamentary officer to give full detail in terms of performance of all the national departments. I'm sure that information has been sent through. If not, it will be coming through. But again, we're just saying on this slide, payment of invoices is an indicator of the efficiency of budget commitment, procurement and payment processes. Yet it's an area that we still come across difficulties for departments to pay. But not only efficiency in terms of budget commitment, but procurement also remains a lever for economic development in the country. For those that are participating in that sector, but also not just participating, talking to issues of unemployment and people making creating jobs in that space. Chairperson, please allow me now to move to the third principle of the public administration, which is public administration must be development oriented. For the purpose of our presentation today, we looked into two issues on public administration must be development oriented. One is that for a state to be developmental, it needs to have the requisite capacity to implement the programs of government. But the second one is on coordination. And on the issue of capacity, what we are saying is that most departments struggle to build a complement of leading experts, specialized skills in their functional areas who can plan and implement key policy administrative changes that will drive development. And often we have skills for routine operations, but measure lips in efficiency and effectiveness. And what we are saying here is that we are working with National School of Government, the DPSA. There's a program around the professionalization of the public service with the PSC. It's also making contributions there to really address this area of work. And also the leadership turnover and policy uncertainty really militates against developmentalism. So these issues are very important and they have to be addressed if at the end of the day we really want to be development oriented. As we move on to the same slide again, we'll touch a little bit around issue of coordination as a very critical issue. Our government has got three spheres of government. System has got three spheres of government, the national, provincial, and local. And in certain instances, it's very important given the concurrence roles for coordination to take place, but also for government to work in a intergovernmental manner to achieve the programs of government. So we looked at post-settlement. And really, we just make an example here, and we are saying to all the programs of government, they should make a reflection in terms of what we found at post-settlement, whether are they adhering to issues of development oriented. And what we're saying is that coordination for post-settlement really should happen at the district level. And for this to happen, post-settlement budgets should be broken down into district level, and district level officials should be given the authority to adjust program features to local conditions and the requirements of coordination partners in the process of mutual adjustment. Support for district coordination is given recently through the adopted district development model. The post-settlement support processes at the moment, it ignores the provincial departments completely, and this creates overlaps and achieves no synergies. Complexity and consequently coordination is increased with multiple overlapping programs. And the funding programs have different eligibility criteria, application forms, application processes, approval committees, implementation processes. The approach of the post-settlement support is overly bureaucratic. And if you look at other programs such as the Comprehensive Agricultural Support Programs and the Recapitalization, which are the main post-settlement support programs, are also top-down. They've taken the top-down approach and cannot significantly respond to local conditions. So whilst on one hand you have got a very good program that is supposed to help us to really deal with the very important issues on the ground of economic development, but also upgrading the lives of the people in the agricultural sector, the way in which we are coordinating, the way in which the administration and the organization of government is set up, it really makes it a little bit difficult for us to coordinate better. Excuse me, Chairperson. And provide this kind of services. And these things, they really do not augur well for a state that is looking towards being development oriented. And in closing on this one, we're saying local officials like extension officers also do not have the authority or the agency to work with farming communities and to be change agent in the local setting. And therefore, we are saying that we recommend that the district level coordination should be used to build on issues that require coordination for a developmental oriented public administration. Chairperson, as I move on to impartiality, fairness, equitably, and without bias, we find that departments, when we interact with them, they've got policies to address this matter. But the challenge that we find is that there is often no reliable data to measure transition and draw inferences about actual implementation and implementation over time on targeted beneficiaries. So this is one area where we said to ourselves, much as we have made inroads in terms of principles such as high standard of professional ethics in terms of setting the infrastructure for ethics and so on. There are certain principles that when we engage with departments and we ask much deeper and harder questions to say, please prove to us that you are impartial, you are fair, and you are equitable and without bias in providing your services, there are still difficulties. But as Public Service Commission, one of the things that we are doing, we are going back again and really beginning to unpack what does it mean to be impartial, fair, equitable in the provision of the services and across different setups of our society. On people's needs must be responded to and public...
Sorry, Ms. Machanja, 1 minute.
Yes.
I think when you proceed now, take it as read because you did receive the presentation, but also just to come towards a conclusion so that we can have more time for members to engage as well, but without suppressing the important points that you must elevate.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the guidance, Chairperson. On this principle, again, we are just saying that the COVID-19 has also changed a little bit the way in which we are going to look into participation with our communities, given the setup that we are working on at the moment. The traditional platforms, perhaps that we used in the past, will need to be reviewed to take into account how we engage members of the society in order for them to participate in our programs. On people's needs must be responded, we are arguing that we need to move away from the answer that says there is a, for instance, a housing program to respond to the needs of the people. We need to give a direct answer in terms of how we're responding to the needs of the people, given the different setups that we have in our country. because one program in the manner in which it has been set up, it may not necessarily work for an area that is Eastern Cape or KZN in the deep rural areas, but it may work for some people in the urban areas. So to have a programmatic response, it's good, but it needs to be improved a little bit. Chairperson, when we moved to an accountable public administration, what we're saying is that despite the national development having done the diagnosis about the accountability that has been eroded, what we picked up is that we have got all the set up and the instruments, and we still remain unaccountable. And the problem here is that 80% of our reporting on our accountability really is more around producing auditable evidence, and we only leave about 20% of that time to reflection on the quality and effectiveness of the service that we are providing to our citizens. Perhaps on this slide again, the large part of accountability is the human value of taking personal responsibility for the quality of our work. The PSC did issue a circular around unlawful instruction, and we're saying that a public servant should never say I was instructed, but always apply his or her mind and take reasonable and lawful administrative action. The same applies to a minister, would never say I was advised, because we have seen with the likes of Isidimini how we are held accountable in our modern times. On transparency, again, we are saying that to be transparent is not just to give information. We need to give information upfront without members of the society asking for that information. That is when we are transparent. So we do see that departments do give information on their website, but there are certain pieces of information that people have to request for the information to be provided. We are happy about that information, but we're saying that we need just to go back and identify who our stakeholders, how do we engage with them, and how do we give them the information upfront. On good human resource and career management, we are lamenting issues regarding the inability to maintain healthy relationship between employer and employee, which has frequently contributed to poor productivity in the public service and low staff morale, litigation and related costs, as well as time commitments of managers in attending to conflict management. And the issue of vacancy rate, we also want to say to the portfolio committee, when you look into this matter, don't just take the word of departments when they tell you that we have got a 9% vacancy rate or we have got 6% vacancy rate, therefore we are within the norm. What we pick up as Public Service Commission is that when you drill down into that 6 or 7%, you find that there are categories of professionals where as the public service we have got a challenge. And we made an example here where we looked into the Department of Justice with the NPA that, for instance, with the category of prosecutors, there may be enough criminal prosecutors, but a huge shortage of prosecutors for commercial crime and corruption. Yet at face value, the department will tell you that we, in terms of vacancy rate, we are within the norm. So it is important that we begin to drill and say, which are these vacancies that are not available. On public administration must be broadly representative, which is the last principle. We are doing well on employing Africans. We're not doing well in terms of women and disability. But most important is we need to also make sure that those that are appointed in positions as women, those that are appointed in positions as disability, they're also given a platform to reflect on the role of the public service in emancipating women in the society, but also contributing to making sure that those that are disabled within and outside of the public service issues are taken into account in policy making and implementation. Chairperson, thank you so much. I'll leave it at that, and I'll give back to Commissioner
No, to me.
Oh, yes, to you, Chairperson. My apologies.
No, on a lighter note. Thank you very much, Ms. Matejo. Let me also acknowledge the presence of all other commissioners at a national level. You are also most welcome. I've seen the new one, the professor, and also Umama Unzimande. and the other commissioners that I might not have seen their names yet. We are all as a collective also most welcome, although you didn't apologize for the chairperson. But nevertheless, let's proceed. That will bring us to NSG presentation. Prof. Ngaweni, over to you, sir.
Good morning, honorable members, and thanks for the opportunity to present. I do have a presentation to share. I will run through quickly some of the slides and focus on a few based on the items that were listed in the request for us to appear before the committee. So, and there might be one or two that slides that are not there, but it's pictures we have added, honorable members and minister, just for illustration purposes, because we are talking about how the NSG was affected by COVID. The picture we are showing is a picture that represents the NSG pre and post COVID. And I will explain later, and you will see some of the numbers, what this graphic means, because 2020 ushered in a new type of an organization. We're forced by circumstance to move into digital and virtual delivery of learning, whereas some years ago, we were delivering largely over 95% of the programs were being done physically. COVID came, and this is the reality of the NSG. And we were forced to, as we had presented to this committee last May, we were forced to rethink our strategies and organization and ask whether are we building a department that is built to last, or it is built to last and to adapt. And COVID really forced us to rethink, go back to the drawing board, and rebuild within a very short space of time an organization that will last and adapt, because if we don't adapt, as COVID has shown, like in the case of this bridge in the Honduras, it was built for years, there was a celebration, it was connecting these communities, it became a corridor of trade, but the river decided to change course and the bridge is now redundant. This happens in any public institution like ours, and unless we build something to last and to adapt, we could easily have, as an NSG, can ended up like this bridge that we see here in the Honduras. As I said, more than 90% of our training programs were delivered through face to face or through contact. But with the national lockdown, auditoriums are not available. Halls were not available, even boardrooms in departments where we conduct the training, they became unavailable because departments were limiting the number of people who were accessing those training rooms in departments. As a consequence, as we indicated before this, the honorable members last year, we're losing more than 10 million rand a month because of all the cancellation that was experienced. And the global pandemic really, you know, created even further challenges for us, because as we're shifting our work to be more reliant on technology in order to deliver our services, we ended up becoming a victim of ransomware. We ended up having to pay about 2 million rand that was unbudgeted for, because we're facing a crisis of losing our ability to use our system. Even people who wanted to train virtually and pay, when we lost the system for about 2 months, we couldn't generate some of the quotations that we're supposed to generate. And therefore COVID had a major impact on our operations. But we were challenged then by the minister and the deputy minister, because they gave us feedback that said we need to try as much as we can to come up with a recovery plan. And this recovery plan involved two things. One, that we saw we had to reimagine ourselves as a department that is driven by innovation, which means we must understand the needs of our client, it must give us a competitive edge, and we have to design bespoke programs that are responsive to ensure sustainability, but also to attract a high caliber of people coming into the NSG. And secondly, as I have indicated, we had to adapt very quickly. As I will show later on, part of the reason that we have survived as a department, besides being able to raise money here and there, was the fact that we did an adaptation very quickly, and using a partnership strategy has actually proven to be a fruitful decision that we have taken. So this recovery plan meant that we had to shift, and you'll see the numbers just now. Most of the work we were doing from phase to phase, because we couldn't train between level 5 and level 3 last year, we couldn't. Where we began to do so, the classes were very small. So you could only have 15 or less than 20 people. If you are training in a department, it had to be about 10 people in a boardroom. In some instances, that is not viable because we are unable to recover the cost of the work that we are doing. And so we're shifting then to use virtual and online. And we had to invest in licenses that we previously did not have, which is virtual and online learning technology, in order for us to reach the numbers. So we then also increased the use of partnerships, because through these kind of virtual learning platforms, it means we can have a class in real time here in South Africa being delivered by an institution in the UK real time. The only difference is it's 2 hours currently because they're in winter, but at any other time, it means you can have South African public servants in a classroom, at times in exactly the same class as public servants from other countries. The important thing to note in this regard was that we approached the minister and made a request that we need to make greater use of media, and with him issuing statements inviting public servants to come and do NSG courses whilst they were at home, especially during levels 4, 5, and 3, and the numbers will show that in fact public servants responded positively to the call that was made by the minister during that period. Finally, in order for us to deliver this kind of the numbers we have to deliver using a virtual and online platform, it requires us to have a greater bandwidth. And to do so, we can't rely on the current SITA line. Even now, as I'm in this meeting, I actually have 2 computers. One is on Wi-Fi. In case this one fails, I'll shift quickly to the other because of bandwidth issues. Now, we had to approach SITA. In fact, that July last year, they are not responding even now, because we do need a second data line, which will enable us to deliver quickly with limited interruption. But that data line will exclude the transversal systems, which must run on a SITA, because the rules say so. But we continue to engage with them, because we're not going to take anything that is uncompetitive in an environment where we can get in the market data lines that may be cheaper, and they will enable us to deliver the programs that we are doing. Also, as part of the recovery, we did it to identify some of the training programs that were traditionally or previously designed for face-to-face and repackage them for virtual training program. Now, in face-to-face, people can come into a class for 5 hours, they have 1 hour break in between and so on. But with virtual, we also must be sensitive to the fact that people can't sit on a virtual platform and learn effectively for more than that. So you have to break them in between, which means the design of the whole delivery model had to be adapted. What you see in the bottom of the page is some of the training programs that were then launched in response to the situation that we were facing at the time. We have reported some of them here to the committee. Some of these programs, which are very significant, we had to go to cabinet to seek cabinet support for those. So when the minister took these programs to cabinet, like the one on the economic governance spring school and on an executive education program we call ETELA, when the minister took those to cabinet and they were endorsed, public servants realized that these are the backing of the executive, and therefore they responded positively to those. As I said in the past, may his soul rest in peace, Minister Jackson Mthembu was the first minister to come and attend the Economic Governance Spring School, which we deliver with the university with Wits University, who bring their intellectual expertise onto this. And when I asked him why Minister Mtembu, you wanted to be the first to join, I said, no, it's fine, Minister Mtembu can be there, but it's because he's the minister responsible for the National School of Government. I must also show that as the president, as a minister in the presidency, I lend my support to the program that has been approved by cabinet. And so we started delivering those, including a very important call on gender mainstreaming and gender budgeting, which we started in August. And many people are attending, and we're encouraged by the gender dynamics in that course, because it's not exclusively women who are joining. DGs are sending men into the course because the issue of gender mainstreaming, gender budgeting, and dealing with anti-discrimination is a collective responsibility. So we are monitoring all those numbers. But also during the national lockdown, you know, we decided that we must have a lot more involvement in the thought leadership space. And we did that through webinars and masterclasses. And we're encouraged that we were able to get very senior people to come and engage with public servants. These masterclasses, they attract between 1,000 and 2,000 people who are attending virtually, including on our other virtual platform. This is a sign that public servants are ready to engage on very critical matters, because it is through engaging such eminent people that they are able to learn and grow out of the experience. It's also important for us to do this because it's building our brand. You know, as you can see, when we bring Professor Sangweni, who was a chair of the commission of the PSC, a lot more public servants are interested to understand from an eminent former public servant like him how we can deal with some of the pandemics and endemics of corruption and governance within the public service. So these are helping us to raise the awareness about the work that we are doing as the NSG, but also offers public servants an opportunity to hear critical perspective. At times they're able to hear about books which are critical, which they may or may not have been able to read for a variety of reasons. Now, as a consequence of COVID, we then lost out on some of the numbers, and this year some of the numbers in terms of our performance. I must say, for example, in the last bullet, since last year 1st of April, a compulsory pre-entry course called NUGELA, or pre-entry certificate, which began last year. And I know our colleagues at DPSA are monitoring these numbers tightly. We almost have a 95% actually compliance rate with this, because DPSA monitors this thing. This means that the pre-entry exam course, which is done by the NSG, over 95% of national and provincial government departments demand the certificate before they make an appointment. In fact, you will not be appointed as an HOD or DG or DDG, nationally and provincially, unless you produce that pre-entry examination. And we've seen that in fact 10,000 people registered and 4,000 people have completed. I got a call from a senior public servant this morning, whom I told to do NUGELA last year and refused. Today he was going to an interview, and they told him they were going to interview, he must make a presentation of his NUGELA project, and he had not done it. And I told him last year that he needs to do it. So you can see that we've got 40,000 people now and more who have registered for the online training program, which means the number is now shifting from what historically was face-to-face and now moving to online. And I will talk briefly about what that means. This is just an example of what we've been doing, because we have been recording at the time. This is an old one, the poster, but I'm using it because we were recording this as a teaser. We wanted to know what are people registering for at the NSG. So, I mean, this is an example of the posters that we will issue when we invite people to come and join, and we tell them you need to have Zoom for you to be able to join these courses of the NSG. Now, with regards to the numbers, the honorable members can note here that we've trained over 41,000 public servants, the numbers are being reconciled regularly. But most important, honorable members, is we're requesting that you must note what appears in the first and the second line. In the second line in particular, Minister will issue a statement encouraging public servants to enroll for the ethics in the public service course. Now, given all the stories that are being told about public servants and so on, it is interesting to note, in fact, based even on what my colleague Irene was saying right now, it is interesting to note that ethics in the public service, which is a free course, self-learning online, is one of the courses that have got the greatest of demand or the greatest of enrollment, over 30,000 within a short space of time. In fact, this course is not new. It predates our being here. And I say our being here, in my case, and the DG only, this week being our first anniversary of being a part of this system, because we joined this week last year. But the numbers have been increasing because the national conversation around anti-corruption and ethics and some of the statements the minister has been making have increased the interest of public servants. Some of them, and the course, though it looks short, is extremely rigorous. Everybody who does it, they come out and say after doing the first module, the course made them feel like they were criminals because they might have taken a stapler from an office or even their office in parliament, took it home to use it for a child's homework and brought it back the following day. And the court asked whether did you have the moral authority to take that stapler away? What if you didn't return it? Where in the rules does it say you must take it and use it home and so on? And that is why it's important the public servants are responding positively. And the one that you see there, which is called the Nugela, compulsory examination written by both public servants and those outside the public service who wish to apply for a senior management course. So if any of the honorable members in this committee would like to apply for any senior position in the public service tomorrow, please note that you will not be appointed. Even if you were a whip or a chair of a committee, even if you were a speaker or holding any other position, you will not be appointed in a senior executive position, national or provincial, unless you've done a new calendar. And the South Africans are responding positively. Now, these courses do differ. When we talk about online, there's a self-learning, which you must register and familiarize yourself. There's also the facilitated e-learning, which is important because we are online and there's a person behind the computer who is helping you to do the work that we do. Now, some of these courses, as I said, are free. But once they are free, they are costing the NSG money. And I will request the CFO shortly to talk about how this COVID has impacted on us financially. So to do this, while they are free, they are costing us money because there's a system that we must invest in. And there are people behind who are facilitating some of the causes. Also, as part of our performance, as I said, we moved into virtual. These are some of the faces, and it's helping us because we're now diversifying participation in the NSG courses. We can have ministers, deputy ministers, we can have mayors of districts, we can have directors and others who are attracted by what we are offering. So as you see on the right, it becomes a typical class now at the NSG instead of it being being in a hall somewhere. What I'm showing here is an example of who is now coming to the NSG as we are aided by technology. This is a group of members of the legislature in Gauteng who are attending an economic governance course delivered by the NSG. And the most important thing about it was a multi-party group from the ruling party in Gauteng, in the ruling benches, as well as the opposition benches. They responded positively and participated in this program. And there were three MECs who were also part of it. Just recently, we were training members of the legislature in the Western Cape who are doing a financial managers course. By first, we are using Zoom, it means we can reach out to people. So this is almost as we were adapting to COVID, is all type of an arrangement that we are having our auditorium here can take up to 100 people, but because of the learning that must take place, we can only take up to 30 maximum. Beyond that, it has a major impact on us. Last day was important for us because for the first time in the history of the NSG, maybe since the building was renamed, they came, met us a couple of years ago, we saw a number of ministers coming into the NSG, respecting the learning program that was taking place at the NSG, and successfully completing the program that we were doing with our partners at VET. Even the former president and deputy president is one of the members of faculty who are teaching in this type of program. The important thing about it is that we are finding that most ministers who are coming to NSG, including their HODs, they tend to send a lot more of their colleagues and employees into the NSG because they are buying into the brand. We also launched a fellowship program which has allowed us to retain the services of senior and former DGs. We don't pay them, I must emphasize that. They come and volunteer on the basis of their knowledge and expertise, and they are part of the faculty at the NSG. We're bringing people from the north and south because we need to give public servants the opportunity to have the perspective both from the global north as well as the global south. In fact, on the left, we'll be sending you as the members of this committee an invitation to attend the masterclass delivered by Professor Mariana Mazzucato on the 25th of April. It's a very important masterclass for about 2.5 hours, and we hope that the members of this committee will be able to attend. As I said, we formed a partnership with ENA in France. Last week, we completed a program. In fact, ENA is an important government school in Europe that, in fact, you will not be able to get a job in key European institutions unless you have done a course there. And so this partnership is helping us also deliver training programs using institutions with vast experience who've done this work since just after the Second World War, which is when the institution was designed. You can't work in Belgium unless you have done a course there. And by Belgium, I mean in the EU institutions. We've got partnerships in London, with University College London. We're delivering a very important program currently, and also a partnership in China with both the Academy of Governance as well as the Academy of Social Sciences, and they are bringing the best of their scholars to provide training to the South African public servants. This is a picture of our partnerships. We say partnerships are the future because, yes, we can deliver with our local partners, but when you bring global partners, you add more weight to the work that we do, you diversify the quality of the products that you are delivering, and we are seeing that more and more people are actually interested in joining us. Now, finally, we're showing this to honorable members so that we have a sense of how we are concluding this year and the financial year, and we will be reporting on some of these later on when we come to report for quarter four in particular. So what we are showing there as being virtual training, these were historically face-to-face courses, and we see public servants are coming back in bigger numbers going to do virtual type training. Hence, we see everyone is busy this month of March, and these are the programs that we have to deliver. We also have some courses that we'll be doing face-to-face because we're now moved into level one. The numbers have grown. We are now beginning to bring a lot more people. There where we say 110 people, it's not all of them in one room, but it's separate venues. We are showing that we are now slowly returning to class because we're now on level one. We've got other big programs that are coming this month. We will send through the secretariat the invitations. We like the honorable members to consider joining some of these master classes and webinars, or even the classes themselves, because they are available to you at a cost, of course. Some of them, others, the master classes are free. So these are some of the high level programs that we'll be doing during this month of March. There is one or two that I've not listed yet because the list is long. I know DG, DPSA is joining a class herself soon at the NSG on digital transformation, and I've said to her, if she pulls out, I'll still charge her money because we have to pay our bills as the school. The colleagues from the Public Service Commission are becoming students at the NSG, but they are also becoming members of faculty at the NSG, which is very significant because they are practitioners and they've got experience. So these are some of the other interventions we'll be doing. The last one here, those members of the legislature I showed you will be having a virtual certification ceremony with them. Historically, based on these partnerships, these are people who have gone to study in various universities in China, but because of COVID, they are now coming here. And yes, we do charge our fee. Importantly here, we now are ready with a course on socioeconomic impact assessment system, where we'll be starting to recruit people. We got the resources to design this course. It is now almost ready. We got them from the presidency. The gender course, it was a partnership with the Department of Women. There's another course on managing the economy post-COVID in partnership with TIPS, which is funded by the DTI. So we are strengthening our partnerships with government departments as well. So in conclusion, despite all the challenges of COVID, we have tested our resilience as an organization. We have been able to adapt the 41,000 numbers we have received. I've shown now a sign that we are adapting as an organization. We do have serious challenges, money-wise, because we lost revenue. Half of the programs we showed you, the money comes late, or some of them are free, the online, yet we are spending money doing those courses. The last thing I wish to say before I ask the CFO to talk about the money is, honorable members, is the fact that if you move NSG courses to virtual and online, you will exclude almost 60% of public servants who do not have computers or data. We have then approached the Department of Communications and Digital Technologies to apply for zero rating as a learning institution. And right now, I can say, we are piloting zero rating with one network provider, which is MTN. What this means is that a frontline worker in Kuruman could, on a Saturday, be doing an NSG course at home on her mobile phone without having to worry about data, because she may be level 2 or 3, could be a cleaner, could be a driver, who don't have the luxury of a laptop as well as a SIM card. So this idea of NSG courses that are online becoming zero rated will have a major impact, because in police stations, police officers during break, they could be going through their smartphones, and they could be registering and studying the ethics course without them having to worry about the data, which is the most prohibitive thing for the most junior of the public servant. And as I said, in many instances, junior public servants do not have access to such instruments. Thank you, Honorable Chair. If I may request the CFO to talk, take you briefly on how the numbers were, and it will be a wrap from us. Thank you.
Please.